Welcome to Trilore Talk. I'm Scott Glovsky, and I'm your host for this podcast where we speak with some of the best trilawyers in the United States. This is a storytelling podcast where we have great lawyers tell great stories of trials that had a significant impact on them. First, I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Tracy Cass. I picked Tracy because she cares, like the lawyers I interview on this podcast. Tracy is from the Settlement Alliance West, and they provide plaintiff attorneys and their clients with comprehensive settlement planning services, including income tax-free and tax-deferred structured settlement annuities, government benefit preservation, trust planning, and more. You can check out their website at www.alliance-west.com. Now, I've mentioned before that this podcast is not about making money, and it never will be. So all of the funds we get from Tracy's sponsorship go to marketing the podcast. And I'm very thankful for her and thankful to you for listening. And I'm also thankful for the wonderful guest we have today, Jim Fitzgerald. Jim is a giant of a trial lawyer, giant of a human being, and truly a special person. He's from Wyoming. And not only is he from Wyoming, but he's been involved in roughly half of the million-dollar verdicts in the history of Wyoming. He's a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, teaches at Trial Lawyers College, and is genuinely just a gem of a human being. And I'd like to thank Jim for joining us, so let's get started. I'm very pleased today to be with Jim Fitzgerald. Jim is a true giant of a trial lawyer and the most humble, real, and caring person. Jim practices in Wyoming and has had tremendous, tremendous, tremendous success. Jim, thanks for being with us.
You bet, Scott.
Jim, could you tell us a story of a case that had a profound impact on you?
Yes, the case would be a case called originally Donahue versus Caterpillar Tractor Company, officially in the Pacific Reporter as Caterpillar Tractor Company versus Donahue, because Caterpillar Tractor Company wound up being the appellant. But I can take you from when we first got the case through trial, through the appeal.
Wonderful.
Okay. So Jerry Dean Donahue was a wonderful man. He was about 35 years old. He had been in the Marine Corps. He was the honor graduate of his training platoon, so he got the Dress Blues Award, a free set of Dress Blues, big honor. And he left the Marine Corps after serving 4 years. And moved to Rawlins, Wyoming. And for a while, he was in law enforcement. And then he had an opportunity to be a heavy equipment operator and went to work for a company called Olson Construction Company. One day, Jerry was out working on a gravel pit, and on an incline in a Caterpillar 988B front-end loader. And the part of the pit sloughed away, and Jerry's front end loader, which weighed something along the lines of 80,000 pounds, rolled a quarter turn, a half turn, crushing him, and then another quarter turn. So it went three quarter turn altogether, a rollover essentially. And Jerry left a widow and three young children. So at that time, I was practicing with another lawyer who's still a great friend of mine. I love him like a brother. We just couldn't be in a firm together. So eventually that firm broke up before the trial of this case. But we're friends today. And he and I had good instincts at that point. I'm at that time probably 5 years out of law school when you get the case, maybe four. So we went to Rollins, Wyoming, which is a town named after John Rollins, who was on the staff of Ulysses S. Grant. Town's named for General Rollins. There's a Rollins Spring. Many of the towns in Wyoming have a Civil War history to them, because right after the Civil War, the railroad was built across the country, and a lot of Civil War veterans worked on it. In any event, we're in Rollins, which is a, a small town. It's in a near picturesque scenery in Wyoming, but it's actually itself on a high desert. And met with Mrs. Donahue and met her three children, just so we would know who they were. And she was just devastated. Here she is, suddenly a widow. Her husband's gone. They'd been a good, close couple. And we sized it up and decided we'd try to help her. Now, before this meeting, she had been turned down by two other law firms that I know of, who had advised her that her only remedy would be workers' compensation, because Jerry was an employee of Olson Construction Company, and at least in this state, in most states, it, receiving workers' compensation benefits is an absolute bar to recovery. In some states, you can elect either the workers' comp benefits or a lawsuit. Here you have no choice as to that. If the decedent, Mr. Donahue, was covered by workers' compensation, it's absolute bar to any lawsuit against Olson Construction Company. So you have to keep in mind, I'm cutting my teeth as a lawyer at this point, and I dug into the law and I found that there was an exception to the absolute bar, and that is if you, in those days, if you could prove that there was a co-employee who had been careless, that co-employee could be made a defendant. And so I listed as a defendant, ultimately, I'll get to that, but one of the foremen at the Olson Construction Company. Also listed a company called H.W. Moore Equipment Company as a defendant, because H.W. Moore had sold this piece of equipment at retail, but it was used. And that company was out of Denver. And also sued, almost as an afterthought, the Caterpillar Tractor Company, because it occurred to me that it was a failure to guard case, that Mr. Donahue's life could have been saved had there been a sufficient rollover protective structure, which I will sometimes in this conversation call a ROPS, R-O-P-S. And so added Caterpillar Tractor Company. I remember one of the first depositions I took was of a, I tried to take, was of an M. Shaw inspector. Did not learn until I got to the deposition that we were not allowed to depose M. Shaw inspectors, M. Shaw being the Mine Safety and Health Administration. You can't depose those people, or at least you couldn't in those days. And so I learned that at the deposition, which actually was set for Rollins, because at the same time the defense lawyers wanted to depose Mrs. Donahue. But let me back up a little bit and just say, one of the things that I fortuitously did after meeting Mrs. Donahue was I contacted the company, which was a company in Casper, Wyoming, 140 or so miles north of Rollins, that had all the parts of this front end loader that had been crushed, and they were taking it apart to see what they could salvage. And luckily, I was able to track that down, and I had an investigator go to the facility where the Caterpillar tractor was being taken apart and photograph it and take possession of such pieces as the salvage people would permit him to take. Turned out one of them was very important to our expert ultimately. But it was just an instinct that let's get our hands on whatever physical evidence we can from this incident. Then I started reading transcripts of others who, other cases against Caterpillar Tractor Company, because as you can imagine, this case was not an isolated case. There were other people who had been killed because there was no rollover protective structure, or as in our case, there was a structure, but it wasn't sufficient to protect somebody in the case of a rollover. So I filed the case. I waited much too long. I filed it about 2 days before the statute of limitations was going to run. And that's a risk I have tried never to take again. And luckily, I had selected some viable defendants. Turns out the best, and who should have only been the only defendant, was Caterpillar Tractor Company on a theory of failure to guard. But in any event, I'll go back to the discovery. As I said, I tried to depose the MSHA investigator, had already driven to Rollins, had a lawyer coming from Rollins from Casper, and another lawyer from Casper. Another one of the lawyers from Casper had called ahead and found out that this MSHA inspector was not even going to show up. So here's one of my first depositions in my entire career. I've got everybody together. I've got a court reporter. We're ready to roll, and no witness. So I learned some things about making sure everything gets pulled together for a deposition. Mrs. Donahue was deposed. She did a very fine job, and her three young children were never deposed. And the defense actually never met them until we were in trial. As I said, I had started to gather transcripts to see how other lawyers would handle these kinds of cases. And I also started doing a lot of research, basic research, into safety issues. And I contacted the Georgia Institute of Technology. In those days, you wrote letters. I wrote a letter saying, I am looking for whatever literature you may have on rollover protective structures for earth-moving equipment. And it turns out that they were able to find some stuff for me. It cost a couple hundred bucks, and I was happy to spend it as a young lawyer. I might add here, I made the decision in that case that I would never worry about costs. I mean, I would keep track of them and keep the clients informed, but I would never say we got to resolve this case because the costs are too high, or we're not taking this case because we can't afford it. I just made the decision early on in my career and with this case, we will bear the costs. If we believe in the case, we're going to bear the costs, and whatever they are, we'll spend them. So the partnership that I had with my dear friend broke up before I filed this case, and I went ahead and filed it. The Georgia Tech materials came in after I filed the case, and there was a man named G. Edwin Burks, who was the vice president of Caterpillar Tractor Company, who had written an article. Ed Burks was a good man, and he had written an article that proved very helpful to me at trial. I also read transcripts of other trials. There was Beck versus Caterpillar Tractor Company, which was tried by Nelson Parrish and Russ Dunn, who were excellent lawyers up in Montana. There was Lanny Vines in Alabama, who had tried a case. Lanny's case was actually what most people would call a cat. It's a bulldozer. But all these cases were against Caterpillar Tractor Company. So I read Lanny Vines' transcript, got my hands on that. I read the transcript of the Beck case. And I plodded along for quite a while, took depositions in Peoria, Illinois, among other places. Peoria is where the headquarters of Caterpillar Tractor Company is, at least their manufacturing side. So I lived in flea bag hotels and I paid for the court reporter and set depositions of a great number of people who had written articles or had were authors of documents that had been produced in Lanny's case and in Russ and Nelson's case. And obtained about 100 documents by contacting lawyers who had already tried cases and went off to Illinois and other places to take testimony from the authors of these papers. One of the documents which became Exhibit 72 was, I believe it was called Caterpillar Design Criteria. And one of the sentences in it was very intriguing, and it talked about the need to build safety into the product. Now, mind you, this was back in the days before corporations strictly controlled their documents, got confidentiality orders, which essentially prevented justice in a lot of cases because lawyers other than me certainly had these cases for years after I had people call up and say, can I talk about your case with you? And I would say, I'll go you one better. The archive is in my storage at my office. You're welcome to come and go through it. Why don't you do that? I'll send you the transcript if you want. You can read that and do essentially what I did. Now, that couldn't happen today because the lawyer would have to persuade the court that asking for this discovery was proportional and was acceptable, and why do you need to ask all these questions, and why do you need all these documents, and have fight all the discovery battles that corporations are able to have us engage in. But in those days, information was freely available, as it should be. But anyway, the system's been changed. So I'm going into quite a bit of detail about that just to say that I knew it would be important to question the same people who'd been questioned before about documents and some new people. So many other law firms, as I mentioned, had done these kinds of cases. Nobody had yet turned up this important witness, Ed Burks. So I had a lot of breaks as a young lawyer starting out, and one of them was when I tried to figure out how to compel Mr. Burks to come to his deposition in some town, not in Peoria, but another town at some distance away from Peoria where he had retired to. And so I sent off some process, and I got a call from this a judge. It was actually the judge. Must have somehow known I was a kid lawyer, and he basically said to me, well, I see what you're trying to do here, but what you really need is this kind of writ in our courts. And heck of a good guy, talk about justice. And he said, so, you know, if you contact the clerk, you can get the correct form. Otherwise, I probably would have never met Edwin Burks. But he had retired, and he had strong feelings about this subject. He had written this paper I mentioned in the National Safety Council newsletter information sheet. I don't remember precisely what it was called, but he had said several things that were quite important to the theory of the case, such as, we need to design safety into our products. We shouldn't be, not in these words, faulting these people who operate our equipment and then it rolls over on them because operation of one of these pieces of equipment in a construction zone is inherently unpredictable in terms of the risks that they may encounter. So there were five or six really key things like that he had said in his paper. So as I said, I got his deposition noticed up and I had sent him a check And I even as young as I was, I kind of had a feeling that maybe this was going to be a pretty good deposition. When he walked in, I introduced myself. And he reached in his vest, suit and coat vest pocket. This man had been a vice president of Caterpillar Tractor Company, very accomplished man, nicely dressed. Pulls out the check, it's made out to him, hands it to me and says, "Your widow needs this money a lot more than I do."
Wow.
So I don't know what the defense lawyer was expecting, but I basically said, "Now, you are G. Edwin Burks, yes, and what was your position at Caterpillar Tractor Company? Such and such. I'm going to hand you exhibit such and such. Did you author this? Yes. And this contains certain opinions you have? Yes, indeed. You wrote these opinions as the vice president for engineering at Caterpillar Tractor Company? Yes, I did. And these are things that you wanted your company to do? Yes, they were. And then I just read them to him. I said, is this one of those things? And then I said, safety should be designed in, or construction zone can be inherently unpredictable. Asked about six of those and said, I have no other questions. And the defense lawyer, of course, had no questions. And so that ultimately was read to the jury, and the document itself became an exhibit, which was very, very helpful to us at trial and on appeal. And I say us because along the way, it occurred to me that I probably did not have the kind of expert I needed, and I needed some help. So I got a hold of one of the Alaska trial lawyers, who by then, when I tracked him down, I found out was living in Bozeman, Montana, Russ Dunn, a very, very bright guy, who ethical, honest, hardworking, West Point graduate, took his commission in the Marines. And some folks will know that you basically, in those days, got a general engineering degree if you went to one of the service academies, which Russ had. And so I asked if he would join me. Yes, he did. And he provided a man named John Bollard, who was a very fine expert witness. So that wasn't long before trial. There were a couple of depositions yet to be taken. There was a firm in California that had done a lot of the work on setting, by regulation, a standard for the retrofitting of heavy construction equipment with rollover protection on a basis of by year of manufacture. And this regulation was adopted probably in about 1972 or 3, and it only went back to about 69 or 67, and what we had was a 1966 Caterpillar front end loader. So the regulations did not apply, but Caterpillar had hired, his name was Woodward, and Mr. Woodward was going to testify about the work that he had done and so on and so forth about, you know, establishing these rollover protected criteria and basically testifying that, you know, before they promulgated them, there really wasn't a way, that it wasn't feasible to create rollover protective structures. There are three things that we really needed to prove: that they were feasible, they were necessary, and they were available. So part of Caterpillar's defense was, well, they really weren't feasible, that's why they called Mr. Woodward. And he had an associate engineer with him, named Clifford Farmer, and Mr. Farmer was basically going to testify to the same thing. So out to California I go, and Mr. Woodward would not travel, and I accommodated Caterpillar Tractor Company by saying, okay, you want to take his deposition for trial presentation, and I'm willing to do that, but I want to take his discovery deposition, and we'll do them back to back. Would be risky if you didn't have some documents in your hip pocket, but I did, and so and they'd been produced in discovery, so I shouldn't say they were, it implied that they were unknown to Caterpillar Tractor. So basically, Mr. Woodward testified on direct at the questioning of Caterpillar counsel after we'd done the discovery deposition, and then I confronted him with some of the documents and neutralized some of his opinions. But we still needed a good expert of our own to counter this feasibility, necessity, and availability issue. And so Russ knew of an engineer named John Bollard, and he became our engineer at trial and testified live, which I think helped. And Mr. Woodward was only on video. And in the end, during the trial, I had mentioned earlier that I had gathered up, through an investigator, gathered up broken parts of the front end loader. And one of them became very, very important at trial because I'm actually thinking that Caterpillar eventually did not call Mr. Woodard, didn't play his videotape, but Russ did a deposition of his associate, Mr. Farmer, and we read that into the record. But basically, Caterpillar had its own employee, Mr. Bordeaux, come, and he was trying to persuade the jury that this Caterpillar tractor hadn't been in a mild roll, that it actually, during the course of the rolling, became airborne and came down flat on its top, and no rollover structure in the world would have saved him. That was basically their defense. So, did it go up in the air and come back down, which sounds preposterous, but we've all seen juries believe preposterous things when they're put forward by a major corporation. And you have to imagine a very large air cleaner, like, you know, 20 inches in diameter. And this would go on the top of the diesel engine that powers the front end loader. And on top of that, there was a spindle, a threaded spindle, like a screw that protruded up about 8 inches above the level of this large 20-inch diameter metal component of the air cleaner. The spindle's purpose was to hold a filter on top of the air cleaner, and actually be the most important part of the air cleaner, and they're fragile. It was crushed and done away with, but this spindle was bent, and it wasn't smashed down. It was very obvious that it had been gradually, although quickly, but gradually bent. And this small piece of evidence that my instincts had told me I might, you know, need to preserve, turned out to be very persuasive. I still have it today in storage, a persuasive piece of evidence to show the jury that this theory that this 80,000-pound piece of equipment somehow leapt up in the air and came down on its top. Now, if you think about it, if it had been a long roll, multiple rolls and on a steep incline, that could certainly have happened. The Caterpillar tractor could have bounced away from the side and ultimately smashed right down on its top. So it's not totally out of the realm of reason, but this piece of evidence, I think, persuaded the jury that Caterpillar's defense theory of their defense wasn't working. So in any event, I did the jury selection, I did the opening statement, Russ put on Dr. Bollard, I cross-examined most of the Caterpillar lay witnesses. In our case in chief, we presented 16 witnesses. Russ presented three of them, which were very important witnesses. In the defense case in chief, they presented 15 witnesses. Russ did two important cross-examinations, and I did the rest. And then in our rebuttal case, we had a lot of fun because we called two witnesses, both by reading in portions of two depositions. One of those had been a Caterpillar expert that they did not call, and we used his testimony to punch some holes in their defense. And we also read in a little testimony of one of our
experts who the court allowed us to call because it was very brief. So that ended the case, and we went on to argument. I did the opening portion of the closing. The defense then did its closing, and Russ presented the rebuttal closing.
How did you prepare to tell the story at trial?
Well, by learning and living with the documents and understanding the chronology and the decisions that went into making Caterpillar tractors, and particularly rollover protective structures. And so I got to know the players at Caterpillar who had designed it. I got to know Mrs. Donahue's own story by sitting down and talking with her, and found out some things about Jerry. I learned what I could about Jerry himself, went through such photographs as the family had of him in the Marine Corps, and talked to his friends and a lot of people in Rollins. And mostly everybody at his workplace was friendly to us, with one exception. And that man wasn't really unfriendly to us, but was jealous about the possibility that Mrs. Donahue might win her lawsuit. And so he withheld some evidence, which we didn't find out about until we were in trial. But the answer is a lot of work to learn the story. The story being partly of his life, but more the story was the development of rollover protective structures. And our theory was they could have done all that work 10 years sooner. There's nothing magical about it. There's no new science. Nothing was required. They just didn't get around to doing it until the government forced them to, with the MSHA regulation that on this kind of equipment you must have rollover and falling object protection. So we go to trial, and it's a no-offer case. So there's a lot at stake. So, as I mentioned, we're through the opening statement now, and we've had our expert on, and now we're cross-examining the defense people, and I mentioned cross-examining Mr. Bordeaux on his theory, and ultimately read actually a portion of Mr. Farmer's testimony about the development of rollover protective structures in rebuttal and rested. And the jury came back with what was then the largest wrongful death verdict in the history of the state, which was $1.5 million. I had dismissed before I ever even asked Russ for to come in. I had dismissed the case against a co-employee at H.W. Moore, at Olson Construction, and I had dismissed the retailer. And they paid a little bit of money. I wouldn't have wanted any money from his co-worker, but his lawyer told him, well, you need to pay him something so you can be out of this. I'll just jump ahead to the end of the story. We ultimately got paid on this case, and I sent the money back to his foreman, who had been named as a defendant, who I wouldn't name today. So jury comes back with that verdict, and we have post-trial motions. The costs started accruing from that entry of judgment forward at 10% a year, which today is what would be a wonderful interest rate if you could just get it. And so we have the post-trial motions, and we won all the post-trial motions. Now the case goes up on appeal. And I sat down with about 20 legal pads. Today you could do it on your computer. And I marshaled all the documents that had come into trial that supported each point. I came up with about 20 different topics. Obviously, necessity, availability, and feasibility were big topics. But as you can imagine, there were other topics as well. Did all that outline physically in my conference room, and came up with the first draft of the brief. Russ read that, made some suggestions. Of course, this is the appellee's brief. Caterpillar appealed on, I don't know how many grounds, 6 or 8. But the appellee's brief turned out to be quite compelling. And the Supreme Court affirmed, and we got the affirmance just about on Christmas Eve, a year and a half later. And then Caterpillar replaced its trial counsel, and they hired new counsel, a well-known firm in this region, to file a motion for a rehearing, which did not succeed. And then Caterpillar Tractor Company hired a firm in Chicago to call and talk to me about settling the case. And said no. Oh, this was actually before the case came down on, before the ruling came down on appeal. And I basically said no. We don't see any reason to do that. We think we got a strong record. And then ultimately, after the affirmance, I got a call from a silk stocking law firm in New York City. And the lawyer was very good. He said to me, he was a good, you know, guy to deal with. He said, so Jim, what would it take to settle this case? And I had already worked out figures. And I said, well, the verdict was $1.5 million. Yes. And the interest, as you know, is at 10%. And, you know, as of last Tuesday, that would have been, you know, 126, whatever it was. And we were also awarded our costs, so that would be this. And if you add all that up, it adds up to, I think it was around $1,622,938.27. He says, yes. And I said, well, that's what it'll take to settle the case. And he chuckled and said, okay, thanks for talking with me. And, of course, it didn't settle for that. But then the opinion came down, and whatever it was by then, they paid.
What impact did this case have on you?
Well, a lot of impact. First of all, this was in the days before verdicts were really widely publicized, as they are now. But there was some publicity to it. So I had already tried some cases and won, and that's how I got this case. It was referred to me by a lawyer who was aware, or a non-lawyer, but a person who was aware of my past verdicts. And as a kid lawyer, I just tried cases out of my heart and my gut because I didn't have enough brains or experience to do anything else. And it had success in getting verdicts. Unlike most states, we do a lot of our work in the United States District Courts here. A lot of people will shy away from federal court. I really like the federal court for many, many reasons. And I had federal court victories. And we had diversity with Caterpillar, so filed there. But after this verdict, then I was better known, especially in this state, as somebody who could try a case and would try a case, and who couldn't be bought out by, you know, costing me out of the case, too much in the way of costs, or couldn't be intimidated out of the case, couldn't be, I wouldn't cower, I wouldn't back down if I thought it was a good case. And frankly, I mean, it's a no-offer case. What are you going to do? You're going to try it. But it propelled me into the next level of work, and I had the privilege of working with Russ again on other cases. Sometimes he would ask me into his cases, and sometimes I'd ask him into my cases. And we've had a long, good relationship, and so I made a friend. He became a very helpful colleague. He's very bright on evidence law, and so I still will call him up and say, hey, I got this issue, what do you think? And he likes to do that. Russ is retired now, but so what did it do? Established me as somebody who knew what he was doing. It made me some new friends. It frankly gave me capital to plow back into the firm because this money was collected when I was probably about 37. I only became a lawyer at the age of 28, so I hadn't been practicing that long by the time the money was paid. And it helped finance a law firm and a law practice.
Jim, you're one of the most humble guys that I know. You're a member of the Inner Circle, probably the most prestigious group for trial lawyers in the United States. And there's a lot of trial lawyers that are, let's say, flamboyant or egocentric. I'm not talking about the Inner Circle. I'm just talking in the larger trial lawyer population. How have you stayed so humble and real?
Well, it didn't always happen. I mean, sometimes when I was younger, you know, I'd get a trial verdict and think I was something hot. But it's come with age, and it's come with the knowledge that there are tragedies in this world, and my job is to not become famous and rich on the backs of those cases. It's my job to try to make things safer. That's my whole goal, always has been. I saw no reason why Caterpillar Tractor Company shouldn't have had a rollover protective structure on those pieces of equipment long before they did. So I believed in those cases. But, you know, at times I've thought, you know, well, I had a lot to do with it. I think the truth is, you know, just tell the truth, find out what the truth is and tell it, keep telling it. And a jury will, in those days, do the right thing. It's harder now because corporate America has done a really good job of persuading people that there are too many lawyers and too many big verdicts and too many of this, too many of that. So it's harder now to win a case, frankly, but still just as important. So if nothing else, the greater difficulty now of winning cases keeps me humble.
And you have been...
I hope I'm humble. You described it as humble. I don't feel that humble. I just know I have to work really hard to keep up and to prevail.
You have been on the forefront of schools of thought for trying cases for many years. I know that you were in the first psychodrama for lawyers with Jerry Spence and Don Clarkson, I believe. Maybe not Don Clarkson.
John Johnson.
And
Don came along not long after that. He was involved.
And you were involved in the last few years in developing the reptile theory that is very prominent among trial lawyers now. What advice do you have as truly a brilliant legal mind, a legal legend, and someone that's been doing this for quite a while? What advice do you have for young trial lawyers?
Well, let me correct one thing. I'm not a brilliant legal mind, but I'm brilliant in this way. I'm brilliant in knowing what I don't know. And I happen to be married to a lawyer, and she has a brilliant legal mind. And she, what I call, speaks judge. So when there is a legal issue, a thorny legal issue, I enlist her to go do the argument. She prepares a lot of the briefs, and we have a common, we have a lot of editing among the lawyers in the firm, which now includes our son, one of our sons. So my advice to young lawyers in that regard and every other regard is ask for help, believe in yourself. If you don't believe in yourself, you know, something to work on. Do work that you find personally compelling. Frankly, you can't just do this for a paycheck. It will eat you up. You have to have a greater purpose in fighting these battles. Unless you just like to fight, which describes a lot of lawyers, but that won't sustain you forever, I don't believe. And if you just like to fight, you may need to exercise better judgment from time on to time on which fights to actually pick. But get to know yourself, be honest with yourself, and let people help you.
Jim, on behalf of your clients, on behalf of your students who you've taught, trial lawyers around the country, and on behalf of myself, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a privilege.
you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.